It's Thursday, May the 19th, 2016, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Coming up, several news sources are now reporting that some wreckage has been found from that downed Egyptian air flight. We'll hear about the treacherous process of removing ISIS bombs from Ramadi, Iraq. Look at a program to teach Arabic to Washington schoolchildren. And talk about superstar Garth Brooks returning to New York after nearly 20 years.
The Yankees actually came to us and said, hey, man, would you ever think about playing Yankee Stadium? It's like, I guess not, but I guess I dream of it.
It's all on today's International Edition. Egypt's aviation minister says the crash of an Egypt Air flight en route to Cairo from Paris was more likely caused by a terrorist attack than by a technical failure. Minister Sharif Fathi discussed the crash even as search operations continued in the Mediterranean. Reporter Edward Uranian is following the story from Cairo and joins us on the line. Welcome, Edward.
Thank you, Susan.
What do we know about this flight?
Well, we know it left Paris late last evening and that it disappeared from radar in Greece about 3:27 local time. It was a flight that was approaching the Egyptian coastline. It was south of the Greek island of Karpathos, and it had probably about 45 minutes left before it was due to land.
Who was on board?
Egypt Air says that there were 30 Egyptians among the passengers, 15 Frenchmen, and one or two passengers from 10 different nations.
And have we heard from any of the families of the passengers?
Yes. Some of the passengers were interviewed by Egyptian journalists on their way to the terminal building where Egypt Air and hospital officials were due to meet them. Several of the older women were crying, and one of the men was very angry and snapped at the journalists. Clearly, those are only the Egyptian passengers, so I can't tell you what's been going in France on the French side. But general consternation, fairly somber mood in Egypt in general over the crash.
Is anything being done for the families? Are they being given any special attention?
Well, certainly they've been kept away from journalists, other than those who are walking into the building and not under the control of the Egypt Air officials. They have reportedly been receiving psychiatric counseling. Clearly, that's one of the practices after a plane crash. Other than that, it's not clear whether the government is going to give them compensation. That sometimes happens during acts of terror or mishaps, rail mishaps. So we still have to wait on that detail.
And speaking of the government, they have been quick to come out and make remarks about this incident.
Well, I think what the retired Egyptian officials have been trying to say in private is that they're worried that another air mishap is likely to further impact the tourism sector, which has already been negatively impacted by the crash of the Russian passenger jet over the Sinai last October, and of the hijacking of an Egypt Air domestic flight to Cyprus last March, in addition to two separate attacks on tourists in Luxor and Hurghada, which are major tourist destinations in addition to Sharm el-Sheikh.
Could you tell us a little bit about the tourist industry there and how it's been affected by these incidents?
Up until now, the Egyptian tourism ministry has been fighting back to try to get tourists from other countries, Arab countries, when tourism has been negatively affected from Europe, from Britain, from Russia. Russia has canceled flights to the Sinai, so has Britain. That hasn't affected Cairo Airport so far. Tourists are still coming to Cairo, still going to other areas like Luxor and Hurghada, as I mentioned earlier. The hotels here in Cairo seem to have a large turnout of Arab tourists, so I don't know in terms of the actual numbers how badly the economic performance is being affected, but certainly Egyptian tourism officials have been trying to fill the gap with Arab tourists.
Well, thank you very much for speaking with us, Edward, today from Cairo.
My pleasure, Susan.
Our social media reporter, Andrew Palchevsky, has joined us here at the Anchor Desk and has got a lot going on the web, social media, Twitter, Facebook, about this story. Welcome, Andrew.
Thank you. Well, it's absolutely a big topic of conversation, this Egypt Air crash. The term Egypt Air and hashtag Egypt Air, those two have been used more than 1.1 million times on Twitter since the news broke last night. So it is a huge topic of conversation. We're seeing a lot of mystery and speculation. Why did this plane crash? Was it mechanical? Was it possibly terrorism? And we're actually seeing airline officials and government officials using social media to try to cut through some of that speculation. That's where they're going to release some of the information that they have as they have it. So they're actually using social media as an information tool rather than one that's going to be speculative.
Excuse me just a minute, Andrew. My director has just told me that Reuters says they have found life jackets now out in the water. So
well,
please continue.
That is something I'm sure social media is going to talk about. Does that mean that there was enough time for people to get out of the plane? Those kind of questions are going to be asked for sure. But then we're also seeing prayers for the victims and their families, the nationalities of the victims. It doesn't appear that there were any Americans on board, but it looks like there were about 20 different countries passengers were from what I'm seeing from various parts of the world. So we're definitely going to see more on that.
Meanwhile, we've got the loss of a major name in a news broadcasting, and it wasn't really expected. Most people didn't know this was going to be coming along the line, but go ahead and tell us.
Yeah, Morley Safer, longtime CBS News journalist. He spent 46 seasons on the 60 Minutes news magazine here in the U.S., has passed away at the age of 84. Now, Morley Safer was in the news just last week because after his 46 seasons on 60 Minutes, he retired, and they did a one-hour special on his life and career and his time spent on the news magazine. And then just a week later, he's news that he's died. Apparently, we're finding out on social media that part of the reason why he retired was because he was in poor health, so that contributed to his decision to retire. But he's certainly been in the news first for his journalistic accolades, and now, unfortunately, because he's passed away.
Well, thank you very much, Andrew.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Time for a look at what's going on the web today, and that was Andrew Palchevsky. The crash of an Egypt Air flight en route to Cairo from Paris was more likely caused by a terrorist attack than by a technical failure, Egypt's aviation minister says. China is demanding Washington immediately cease close surveillance along the country's coast following the Pentagon described as an unsafe encounter between two Chinese fighter jets and a U.S. plane. New data shows life expectancy rose by 5 years between 2000 and 2015. A roadside bomb explodes today in southern Afghanistan, killing a top Afghan army commander. The most expensive jewel sold at auction, a rare 14.6-carat blue diamond, has a new owner, and it's not me. News, feature reports, and more are on the voanews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
An international team of researchers say that they have discovered around 80 galaxies that may have existed in the young universe about 12.6 billion years ago. The team developed a list of galaxies to look for from data gathered by the Subaru telescope in Hawaii. With that information, they were able to locate these 80 early galaxies and learn more about them by analyzing imaging data gathered by the Hubble Space Telescope. About 13.6 billion years ago, that's 200 million years after the Big Bang, it's thought that cold gas clouds provided material for the first stars to be born. As these stars were being created, they formed small galaxies. The researchers were able to determine that around 1.2 billion years after the Big Bang, these small galaxies were continuously merging together and growing into larger galaxies like our own Milky Way, which contains about 200 billion stars. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
U.S. experts working to clear the Iraqi city of Ramadi of bombs planted by Islamic State say it could take decades and millions of dollars before the city could be deemed safe to live in. Correspondent Sharon Bain is filing on this story and joins us on the line today from Baghdad. Hi, Sharon.
Hey, Susan.
Say, Sharon, what do you know about this story?
Well, actually, I spoke to the members of Janus Global, which is a company that's been contracted by the U.S. government to sort of search and assess the damage in Ramadi. They didn't want their names used. There's some, you know, security concerns, and I agreed to that, and we just spoke pretty openly about it. And what they're saying is that this is a pretty widespread city. It's about 180,000 square kilometers. So it's, you know, it's a big area. And what they've done is started to clear the schools and the infrastructure, and that's taken quite a while. But the real challenge, they tell me, is when they get to the urban and residential areas, because what ISIS has done is apparently plant bombs, you know, just about anywhere where they could even think of doing it. So it could be in a cushion. It could be in a closet. There have been reports of even bicycles being booby-trapped so that when people get on a bike, it blows up. It's just quite horrendous.
How many victims have there been from this kind of situation in that area in Ramadi?
Well, what happened was that some of the families started to go back home once the city was cleared, and the families had fled and they were staying in refugee camps, and they started to drift back home, and you know, as families don't want to do, they want to see their homes. And they're entering these buildings. One, where the buildings are unsafe, and two, you know, they're booby-trapped. And there have been reports that, you know, several dozen people have already been killed by this. You know, they'll set off a booby trap or they'll step on something. And it's quite tragic, but, you know, you can't really stop people from going home.
What kind of special equipment are they using to help clear these mines?
Well, right now what they're doing is that they'll cordon off a section. They have two 20-man teams, and then those are split into little two-man teams. They'll cordon off a section and make lanes, and then search and look at. But right now, they'll clear the IED debris, they'll clear explosive debris, things that are not likely to go off. So they'll use they do a lot of sort of visual surveying before they go in. And then what they're doing is that they're finding these homemade explosives inside things like jerry cans and plastic containers. They're finding them inside pipes. So those parts that they found so far have not rigged to go off. When they find something rigged to go off, they actually call in the Iraqi army and the bomb disposal unit to take care of it. You know, this is just a sort of first step where it's visual recognition, visual surveying, identifying what they can take out, the debris that they can take out. And then the things that they know could explode, could cause a lot of damage, then they call in the army to do that, or the police.
This situation is very scary for residents and for those of us observing it from outside. What kind of living conditions do they have beyond these bombs that they have to worry about every moment?
Well, the people who live there are living in terrible conditions. You know, this company that's doing the assessment and the initial clearing, they just finished the water plants, the two water plants, and I think five schools is what they've done so far. So just the basic infrastructure first has to get cleared so that those families can get even the basic services. But if you look at photographs at Ramadi, it is just, it's astounding. It's just been leveled. There's just house after house and building after building in ruins. It's all in rubble. So some of these families that are going back into unstable buildings that are half blown up. It's really quite devastating. They have a very difficult, they are living under very difficult conditions. And, you know, for the people clearing it, that company also, you know, they have security concerns. They won't allow their faces to be shown, for example, you know, in case there's any kind of revenge attacks. And it's also, you know, part of Ramadi, the north part, is pretty close to the front line. And ISIS still can do sort of hit-and-run attacks, so that's a concern also. And another thing that the company told me, the members of the company told me, was that, you know, apart from the logistic complications of bringing in the equipment and the personnel and so on, it's close to, you know, 100 degrees out there. And this is very hard and painstaking work. So the environmental factors are something else that they have to take into consideration.
Well, thank you very much for speaking with us today, Sharon, from Baghdad.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up on International Edition, learning Arabic in Washington schools, and Garth Brooks heading to New York City. There is no national mandate for Americans to learn foreign languages. While school children in other countries often learn at least one other language as part of their curriculum, kids in the United States may not have that opportunity depending on the requirements of their school districts. The Teachers of Critical Languages program aims to change that. In this television report, Arash Arabasadi has more about how this program affects students and teachers alike.
The magic key to teach any language is culture.
Tamer El-Sharkawi is a school teacher.
It gets it easier for you and for the kids if you try to connect what you are teaching to something authentic from this place that you are teaching the language from. Marhaba.
He's here as part of State Department's Teachers of Critical Languages program, which brings educators from Egypt and China to the U.S., where they'll teach American school kids their native languages and cultures.
Some parents reached out with me to because they wanted to know how to deal with their children here in Washington, D.C., about this kind of stuff like the Islamophobia. How can they are not Muslims, but they want to teach their children something correct about this topic. So this is the other part that we are doing. Can you say it, Jason?
Many of these kids are Spanish speakers. They're learning English as a second language, and now they're learning Arabic.
I really believe in students having a global education and an international outlook.
How did you know it's a rabbit and not a bunny? What clues did you use?
Flora Lehrenman teaches English to non-English speakers. She enrolled Cook Elementary in the TCLP.
When students are learning multiple languages, they end up learning all of them a lot faster.
And like any cultural education, both sides learn from each other.
I started to change my point positively towards generally to Americans. I don't depend on the media more to tell me that Americans hate Arabs, Americans hate Muslims. You know, it's not like this. Assalamu alaikum.
El-Sharkawi says he's learning a lot just from being in Washington.
I think Washington, D.C. is like the most fantastic place for anyone from any nationality to be here. It's the most wonderful experience that anyone can have in the United States. Lots of colors, lots of religions, lots of people, lots of backgrounds.
Love it! Montaza! And
El-Sharkawi says he knows the children might not remember all the Arabic words they learn in class. They might even forget his name. But perhaps they will remember that they had a teacher they liked and respected. Perhaps they'll remember he was an Arab. And perhaps they'll remember he was a Muslim. In Washington, Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
Can you say it?
This is VOA.
From science and technology, here's what's new.
What's new? The Loppy Fit. Bruin Burgmeister didn't like sitting on a bike after a long day sitting in an office, so he invented the Loppy Fit, which combines a walking treadmill with an electric bike.
When I was walking on my treadmill in my fitness room one day, I thought, why not bring the treadmill outdoors?
And that's what he did. He built a bike that moves forward by walking on a belt in the middle of an elongated bicycle. A small electric motor ensures the bike reaches sufficient speed for a typical bike ride. It runs on a battery with a range of around 55 kilometers. Burgmeister built the bike in his living room in the town of Valte in the Netherlands.
On rare occasions, some people would really laugh at me, but then I'd think, can't really blame you. It does look a bit odd.
Odd and expensive. The Loppy Fit's price is more than $2,000. Brings to mind just how many average bike riders will be using the Loppy Fit. For VOA's What's New, I'm Todd Grossons.
It's been nearly 20 years since country music superstar Garth Brooks played for an audience in New York City. But as International Edition's David Byrd reports, the multiple Grammy Award winner is set to play at Yankee Stadium in July.
Blaming all of my roots, I showed up in belts and ruined your blind time fear.
The last time Garth Brooks played New York City, 750,000 people showed up for his 1997 Central Park show. Brooks, who has also won multiple Entertainer of the Year awards from the Country Music Association, returns to the Big Apple with a concert at Yankee Stadium July 9th. At a news conference for the show, Garth said that he jumped at the chance to play in New York again, especially at Yankee Stadium.
It wasn't my thought. It wasn't my brainchild. The Yankees actually came to us and said, hey, man, would you ever think about playing Yankee Stadium? It's like, I guess not, but I guess I dream of it, you know? And so I said, are you really serious? This is possible. They said, yeah. I said, well, what a way to return to New York after Central Park. So this makes sense. If you're going to do anything big, you do it in this city. If you're going to do something big in this city, Central Park, Yankee Stadium, I think that's the way to do it.
Brooks, who released his latest album of original songs in 2014 after a 13-year hiatus, said he wanted to perform for his devoted fans. The 54-year-old singer and guitarist said he gets emotional when he thinks about what music has meant to him.
Or they talk about your musical heroes or what music means to you. Man, you don't talk about what music means to me, it's going to get really sappy really quick, because that's my breath in and my breath out.
Garth Brooks's tour has recently sold its 4 millionth ticket, but he says he still enjoys watching and learning from other performers.
Well, I mean, you got guys like Jason Aldean, who's a true entertainer, which I like. And I know it's not country we're talking about. We just saw Justin Timberlake, another true entertainer. I was lucky enough to get to see Beyonce's Vegas show that she built solely for Vegas. I got to see it in person. Entertainer. I mean, take out your notebook and take notes. No matter how long you've been on the stage, take notes on that one. And just guys like that. I love them.
Tickets for the Yankee Stadium show go on sale May 20th. Brooks and his wife, Trisha Yearwood, will perform, but there's no definite word on whether New York's own Billy Joel, who joined Brooks in his 1997 show, will also be there. I'm David Byrd, VOA News.
Right now, we have more on our lead story. Wreckage from a missing Egypt Air flight has been found in the Mediterranean Sea, the Egyptian Ministry of Civil Aviation says. Flight MS-804 disappeared during a flight from Paris to Cairo with 66 people on board. The debris near the island of Karpathos included life jackets and plastic items, Egyptian officials say. Cause of the incident has not yet been determined. Well, we want to thank you, though, for joining us today for this edition of International Edition.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States and Japan are leaders in the global digital economy, not just as producers and consumers, but as advocates for policies that enable its existence and development. Our partnership is strong, said U.S. Deputy Assistant Secretary of State and U.S. Coordinator for International Communications and Information Policy, Daniel Sepulveda, because we both believe that promoting continued global connectivity holds the potential to help lift people out of poverty, formalize the informal economy around the world, increase the efficiency of supply chains, increase the productivity of workers, raise wages, and improve people's lives. At the recent G7 Information and Communications Technology Ministers meeting in Japan, a new charter for the digitally connected world was agreed to. The charter reaffirms fundamental principles, including promoting and protecting human rights, promoting and protecting the free flow of information, supporting the multi-stakeholder approach to internet governance, and strengthening digital connectivity and supporting inclusiveness for all. The Global Connect Initiative, launched by the U.S. last fall, is a large-scale effort to increase internet access around the world. The U.S. intends to partner with interested countries, including Japan, to develop strategies to spur connectivity and entrepreneurship, cross-border information flows, and open and competitive marketplaces. The Trans-Pacific Partnership, of which Japan is a part, will play a supporting role in the shared goals of strengthening the global internet. The internet represents the digital shipping lane for 21st century goods and services, and as such, the pending agreements with nations in the Pacific community will establish rules for the preservation of those virtual shipping lanes as means of conveying services and ideas, allowing startups and everyday people to challenge incumbent power in marketplaces and ideas. The United States and Japan share a common vision for the future of the global digital economy by expanding connectivity, keeping digital trade routes open, and creating policy environments that sustain growth and foster innovation. These are valuable long-term efforts, said Deputy Assistant Secretary Sepulveda, and we have the strong bonds as friends and allies that will help us succeed.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.